Thank you, Goran, for your kind words of introduction, and thanks, of course, to the organizers for inviting me. It's my third time in Toronto, and my first time at Fields, as my previous academic links were at York University. Very pleased to be here. Incidentally, I'm on the program as Nicholas Bingham. I don't quite know who he is. I'm Nick or Nick Bingham informally, and formally I'm N.H. Bingham for Nicholas Hugh. I noticed to my mortification that I forgot to capitalize the name of my friend and collaborator John Fry. So please read Fry in capitals. It's basically the same name as Rüdiger Fry, but spelt differently the Anglo-Saxon way. So multivariate elliptic processes, and this is going to be a play in three acts, static, dynamic Lévy, and dynamic diffusions. We've heard quite a lot about Lévy processes so far. I actually trawled through the abstracts, counting the number of people who had Lévy in their abstracts, and I think the count came to five, six including me. For some reason, my abstract isn't in the booklet, but I did send it, and I believe it's on the website. So the moral is, send the tech file as well as the PDF, as I will learn in future. And we've also heard about diffusions. We had a lovely talk yesterday from Alex Mijatovic, who really held up a microscope to one-dimensional diffusions, a very, very classical subject, from the point of view of variations on the idea of arbitrage. I'm basically a straight probabilist who, like most probabilists, I would say, morphed into being partly a math finance type, because it's very difficult not to these days. Aha! Don't we all know? And within probability, I think it's a rare probabilist who is genuinely ambidextrous between Lévy processes and diffusions. Most of us have a preference. You give a guy a football, and it's a rare footballer who doesn't reveal his footedness within 30 seconds of being on the ball. I'm left-handed, and I'm left-footed, so I'm basically more of a Lévy guy than a diffusions guy, but I like both, and we need both, and we've got both, so we might as well use them. Okay. List of references for the paper on which this talk is based is quite long, but I decided to be fairly brief in the bibliography I cited in this talk. At risk, it now occurs to me, of seeming a bit on the monomaniac side. For those who want to see the full text, watch the journal Statistica Neerlandica, where the full version of the talk is going to come out reasonably soon. Some of you may remember, Rüdiger Kiesel and I wrote our book on risk-neutral valuation a while back, but the first actual papers we wrote appeared in 2001, and they were on generalized hyperbolic processes, both appearing in conference proceedings volumes, one edited by Steve Satchel, and the other co-edited by Lane Houston, who's here. And generalized hyperbolic distributions and processes are very interesting, and I still like them, but we decided to explore the theoretical framework without being specific to generalized hyperbolic, and that led to our paper in quantitative finance in 2002, which was followed up by a sequel with Raphael Schmidt, who's now left academia, sadly, I hope not forever, in 2003. And then there was a further follow-up by myself and Raphael in the Sherry IFS drift a wonderful volume based on a wonderful conference that took place in the French Alps in 06. Okay. At risk of seeming to teach my grandmother to suck eggs, I decided to stick up on the record some of the underlying theory. Lurking in the background is the stochastic differential equation for geometric Brownian motion, also known as economic Brownian motion. To the best of my knowledge, this was first advocated in the context of mathematical finance by the late Paul Samuelson, who died quite recently and whose recent obituaries you may remember. If you missed them, Google Samuelson's obituaries. He was a remarkable man. And to take the first displayed equation, I'd like you to imagine, first of all, ladies and gentlemen, that the ST factor on the right is missing. So what we're doing is looking at dST on the left, S for stock, equals mu dt plus sigma dB of t. This is the Bachelier model. Bachelier's famous thesis, Théorie de la Spéculation, in 1900 or 1901, I always forget which. Thank you. And if Mark Davis were still with us, he would have been able to chip in also. As you may be aware, there was a reissue of Bachelier's thesis translated into English with scholarly commentary and a foreword by Paul Samuelson. And this was published by, edited by Mark Davis and Alison Etheridge 2 or 3 years ago. I have a copy which they both inscribed at the book launch, which was a very nice party. So it is to Bachelier that we owe the concept of using stochastic processes to model the evolution of such things as prices, and it is for this reason that the Bachelier Society takes its name. Now, of course, Brownian motion, even with a positive drift, can go negative. Prices cannot go negative. Prices can reach zero, which is death or bankruptcy, depending on how you choose to view it, but prices don't go negative. And consequently, the Bachelier model, vitally important though it is from a historical standpoint, isn't the whole story, and we nowadays, following Samuelson, use the factor of ST on the right. At which point, I can't resist telling you a story about the late, great Kiyoshi Ito. One of my sadnesses in life is that I never met Ito, although I have excellent academic links in Japan. And I once heard Terry Lyons telling a story about when he spoke at the conference in honor of Ito's 80th birthday in Kyoto, which must have been in 1995. And my memory of Terry's story is that Ito told Terry Lyons at that meeting that that stochastic differential equation was Ito's motivation for the Ito calculus. Anybody based in Oxford, please confirm that with Terry, but that's certainly my memory. Okay, so we solve this in the usual way, the Dorion-Dade exponential, and in particular, S of t has a log normal distribution, and the point of this talk is to move to many dimensions. We're going to be working in d dimensions, and I'd like you to imagine that d is large. Okay, so we've got a d vector of means, we've got a d-dimensional Brownian motion, we've got a d-dimensional price process, log normal components, and a d by d covariance matrix. So log prices are multivariate normal or Gaussian. And this is a very nice distribution whose characteristic function is of this form, exponential of a linear and a quadratic. And life immediately gets a little complicated depending on whether or not sigma is singular. In this talk, I'm going to restrict to the generic case when sigma is not just non-negative definite, which it always will be, but positive definite, in which case the law is absolutely continuous and we can write down its density according to that lovely formula there, which is due to Edgeworth in 1893. It's nice to have a good excuse to write up some 19th century mathematics with dates attached. Okay. Now to say a word or two about Markowitz. I'm always tremendously envious of people who write theses that are so good that they become part of the canon. Now, how many people does that apply to? The great Gauss, Disquisitiones Arithmeticae, 1801 perhaps. How many people write a PhD thesis that is of ongoing mathematical importance? Within our field, the obvious two are Bachelier, whom we've mentioned already, and Harry Markowitz and his thesis of 1952. And Markowitz gave the world two concepts which are so blindingly obvious that they now form part of the ambient culture, and it's an effort to gaze back into the mists of time and realize that these things haven't always been part of the ambient culture. Now, I remember 1952 very well. I was 7 at the time, but I wasn't involved with mathematical finance then, so I'm afraid I'm going to have to ask you to take it on trust that these insights really were genuinely new. In brief, one, Markowitzian insight one, look at risk and return together. Blinding glimpse of the obvious one. Blinding glimpse of the obvious two, diversify. Hold a range of assets, deliberately diversified across different sectors of the economy. It's often said that there's nothing in life certain except death and taxes. Another way of saying much the same thing is that the only certain thing in life is change. Whatever it is you're holding now, circumstances will change, and some of the things that you're holding now will be hurt by the change. If you have genuine balance in your portfolio and lots of negative correlation, then what you lose on the swings, you will tend to gain on the roundabouts. All very obvious, but very important to emphasize. Okay, problems. Well, the Black-Scholes model gives us everything Gaussian, and whereas I love Gaussianity as much as the next fellow, there is no denying the fact that Gaussian log prices have ultra-thin tails. In my wallet, I have something which is only of historical interest now. It's a German 10 Deutschmark note from before the introduction of the euro in 1999. And as the Germans here present will remember, the 10 Deutschmark note immediately before the euro had a picture of Gauss on the front and a picture of the Gaussian density, and on the back a map of Gauss's triangulation of Hanover. And the artist who did the design made the Gaussian density look as if it had compact support. And that is an illustration of how unrealistically thin, ultra-thin, Gaussian tails are. Okay, so what one would like to have is all the lovely things to do with Gaussianity without being trapped in the Gaussian prison of tails being extremely thin and actually far thinner than one encounters in practice. And one can do this. With one bound, we are free. The reason that Gaussian tails are thinner than is realistic is because we go x of minus a half in the Gaussian density in Edgeworth's formula. So why don't we drop the x of minus a half and stick something else in? And if we do that, we get the theory of elliptically contoured distributions. There's a very nice book on this by Sam Kotz and two other authors, one of whom is called Ng, and I'm afraid I've blanked out on the name of the third author, which is embarrassing, but Kotz, somebody, and Ng. And in there you'll find lots and lots of nice results, and in particular you'll find a stochastic representation there. Knock off the mean, so we're working with centered vectors, and a D vector, random D vector, when centered. If it's elliptically contoured, it can be represented in this nice way. R is a positive stochastic process. A is what I think of, what one can think of, as sigma to the half, the square root, positive square root of the variance matrix. And U is uniformly distributed on the D-sphere. Notice that the burden of dimensionality, which may be large, is carried by U. A is D-dimensional, and so you're going to have a certain amount of heavy lifting to do, because when you're working numerically, you have to be able to handle D by D matrices for large D in a confident and efficient way. But lots is known about this. A book by Golub and Van Loan, for example, is a very, very good source here. And the stochastics live in one dimension. So that's really the message here. Lurking in the background, of course, is the curse of dimensionality. Yes? Well, absolutely. Sure. Well, I'm an academic, you're an academic. Somebody somewhere is investing our pension funds. Now, how many assets do you want the guy who's managing your pension fund to hold on your behalf, to provide for you in your old age? 50? I don't want to crowd the guy. I want to allow him to look around, do his job. I can't be bothered with that. I'm a theorem prover, basically. But he is a stock picker, and I want him to be able to pick stock without thinking, I'm up to my limit, I can't handle the computational complexity of buying into new investment opportunities as they occur. I actually don't know what the range of, what the cardinality of the portfolio held by my pension fund is. All I really know about my pension fund is that they're reliable and will pay me a proper pension. Shall we say 50? Would that satisfy? Good. Okay. Lurking in the background is the curse of dimensionality, a lovely phrase due to the late Richard Bellman, and we are to be thoroughly frightened by situations where the computational complexity explodes with dimension. If the computational complexity increases exponentially with dimension, then as dimension increases, we're dead. So we want to find ways of taming the curse of dimensionality, and in brief, the reason why elliptically contoured is so lovely is because the stochastics live in one dimension, and one dimension, one is not large, so that's nice. Okay. Examples. Well, examples are legion. Gaussian, we started with. Student T distribution in D dimensions with n degrees of freedom, where the relevant function, the density generator G, is a constant. I never worry about constants. You can pick them up from normalization. And 1 plus quadratic form over n to the appropriate power. And bearing in mind that 1 plus x over n to the n increases to e to the x, which is exponential growth as the limit of compound interest, as the interest is compounded continuously, you can see the Gaussian as the limit of student t as the number of degrees of freedom increases, floating out of the Merck. And it's also worth noting how something with power decay for finite d morphs into something with exponential decay in the limit as d goes off to infinity. Okay, and now, decay like a power. Many members of the audience have a physics background. In fact, I suspect there are more people in the audience with a physics background than a straight math background. And the nice thing about that is that you can appeal to people's physical experience and insight. For all sorts of reasons to do with renormalization and such like, physicists expect power law behavior in a wide range of situations, including the situation relevant here when we have high frequency returns. We may have kick data, for example. And indeed, my paper with Raphael Schmidt, BS, on the first slide, is devoted to exactly this. I hope that I'll have time to say more about kick data a little bit later. Okay, and the student T is closely related to Gaussian, not just in the sense that I've mentioned already, that we can pick up Gaussian as the limit as d goes off to infinity, but it's also a normal variance mixture. So if we have a random covariance matrix U sigma, where sigma is what we've met already and is fixed, and U is a positive random variable, and mix over U, then we get the student T. And so this is called a normal variance mixture for that reason. And the law of U is called the mixing law and is inverse gamma. Generalized hyperbolic is a third example. And here the mixing law is generalized inverse Gaussian, or GIG. And the nice thing about these three examples is that they give us, if you like, the three prototypical situations. It's a little bit like physics. There's the macroscopic world, objects like us. There's the microscopic world, objects like atoms and molecules. And there's the mesoscopic world, objects like Brown's pollen grains dancing around in water, and dust particles dancing around in sunbeams. And I can vividly remember, as a boy of about four, seeing dust particles dancing in sunbeams and asking my mum why they were dancing about. As a matter of interest, how many of you can remember the same experience? Michael Menoris, gentlemen. Wonderful. Very nice, yes. Okay, so if we have long return intervals, say monthly, then we get aggregational Gaussianity, the central limit theorem applies, and we get the Gaussian or the Black-Scholes model. The rule of thumb, I understand, is that 16 working days, trading days, will do, but let's round it to a month. At the high frequency or tick data end of the spectrum, power law behavior comes out of the murk for reasons reminiscent of physics. And in between the two, say with daily returns, you get typically things like generalized hyperbolic. And with the generalized hyperbolic, it's actually quite an instructive thing to think of. I've mentioned the Gaussian density already. But I would like you to change in your mind from the picture of density to the picture of log density. If you think log density, Gaussian is a parabola. The generalized hyperbolic is a hyperbola. And so one branch of a hyperbola has two linear asymptotes at infinity. And so the log density decays linearly rather than quadratically, as is the case with Gaussian. Okay, so that's note one. We vary the return interval that alters the character of the return distribution a lot. Secondly, returns correspond to discrete time, and log prices are more suitable for continuous time. And so one is driven to wonder whether one should be in discrete or continuous time, which I will come back to later. Okay, well, we all know about Levy processes. Just to point out the relevant examples here, in the Gaussian case, we have Brownian motion. In the Poisson case, which I haven't talked about much, we have Poisson processes. In the case of student t-distributions, we have student processes. There's a very nice paper by Chris Heide, sadly no longer with us, and Nikolai Leonenka of Cardiff, I think. And in the generalized hyperbolic case, GH distributions and processes. Okay, self-decomposability. Infinite divisibility is lovely, but sometimes it's nice to have more than straight infinite divisibility, and the family of self-decomposable distributions is a subfamily of the infinitely divisible distributions, which is particularly useful here. And the definition of self-decomposability is that for each c in the open interval from 0 to 1, we call x self-decomposable if it's got the same distribution as c times itself plus independent sum, something else, which of course is necessarily allowed to depend on c. And for those of you with a time series background, this is irresistibly suggestive of an autoregressive model in time series of all of one. Of course, we can express this in terms of characteristic functions like so. And the important thing to note is that SD is a subset of ID, that we can pick up exactly which laws are SD by looking at the form of the density of the Levy measure in the Levy-Kinchin formula, which, to save time, I haven't written up, you all know it. And examples of SD are the Gaussian, the student T, and the generalized hyperbolic. And the next thing I want to talk about is type G, I presume G for Gaussian. And the definition of type G is that it's a law obtainable as a product. So Y is of type G if it's of the form sigma epsilon, where epsilon is a normal B vector with mean zero and covariance matrix sigma, same sigma as before. And little sigma is a random variable independent of the D vector epsilon with sigma squared identically distributed. Under those circumstances, which may seem artificial if you've never seen them before, under those circumstances we say that Y has type G. The name and the concept goes back to Mike Marcus in 1987. There is a very nice memoir of the American Mathematical Society, which I am the proud owner of a copy. I wrote to Mike, whom I've known well for about 40 years now, begging him for a copy, and he eventually found one and sent it to me, nicely inscribed. And we can specify which characteristic functions arise in this way. Psi of t, the characteristic function on the left, is phi of half t transpose sigma t on the right, where sigma is the Laplace-Dilthey's transform of phi is the Laplace-Dilthey's transform of little sigma squared. And under those circumstances, if we add on the mean, we get something elliptically contoured. And we're going to specialize from sigma squared ID to sigma squared SD, and then we can check as above that X is also SD. The message of the static work in BK and BKS is this is a very nice framework to work in for modeling purposes, and to my embarrassment, the concept of type G is not made explicit there. Sort of implicit, but I kicked myself when I eventually came across it. there's been a lot of interest in type G from the theoretical viewpoint in the last 5 years or so. Barndorf Nielsen, whose name I should have mentioned much earlier, my involvement in this area was triggered by trying to make sense of Barndorf Nielsen's extensive writings here, and various Japanese collaborators of Barndorf Nielsen, among others. Very nice stuff. Okay, the dynamic picture. If you remember the stochastic representation called SR, and if you don't remember it, it doesn't matter at all, because you can reconstruct it from the equation displayed up there just by dropping T's everywhere in sight. This is a self-consciously naive dynamicization of SR. Just stick a suffix T in appropriately. On the left, we've got a d-dimensional stochastic process. R on the right is a stochastic process on the positive half line. And U we're going to take to be Brownian motion on the surface of the d-sphere. We then call X a multivariate elliptic process, or MEP, with risk driver R. Interpretation, X is the log price process of our portfolio of assets. We know from Markowitz that we're going to need mu and sigma, and we're going to assume that the variability can be adequately modeled by a one-dimensional driving noise process, which we'll call the risk driver, which represents the uncertainty in the economic environment. Now, I don't know how much of a statistical background a typical member of the audience has. To a statistician, thinking in terms of factors comes very naturally. There's a whole area of statistics called factor analysis. I don't really believe that the world is one-dimensional in this sense, but what I do think is that this is a useful approach for modeling purposes. I cannot resist quoting a dictum due to George Box of Box Jenkins and Box Cox. All models are wrong. Some models are useful. It's worth bearing in mind. I think this is a useful model. Of course it's wrong. Okay, so we duck the curse of dimensionality because the stochastics live in one dimension, and if we look at the conditional variance there, we get R squared times sigma, and so if we take expectations, we get the expression there, which I've called vol, for the variability. So this gives us stochastic volatility, which is one of the stylized facts of mathematical finance, and large or small values of R tend to be followed by large or small values also, which will give us volatility clustering. And that's also nice because it's another stylized fact. Processes of Ornstein-Uhlenbeck type. dV of t is minus cV of t plus sigma dB of t. This is a picture of the dynamics of a Brownian particle. dV of t is the change in the velocity. Minus cV of t on the right is the frictional drag. And sigma dB of t is the perturbing noise, because our Brownian particle is being bombarded by lots and lots and lots of water molecules, or our dust particle by air molecules. And we can generalize this by replacing the Brownian driving noise by a Levy driving noise. And one of the nice things here is that one can look up all the relevant theory in the book by Sato. Sato's book is a treasure house of good things, and it should be used, in my opinion, in tandem with Jean Bertrand's wonderful Cambridge tract, Levy Processes. Bertrand is wonderfully probabilistic. Sato is sternly analytical, but my goodness me, there's a lot there. And in particular, you'll find everything that we need about OU processes driven by Levy processes in Sato's book. Okay, the first note here is about log prices. So this gives us a model for the log prices of a d-dimensional portfolio, which is nice insofar as the dynamics are driven by a one-dimensional noise process, and the thing is stationary and settles down to equilibrium. And secondly, this links up with the Barndorf, Nielsen, Shepherd work on stochastic volatility, which saw the light of day in a very well-known discussion paper for the Royal Statistical Society. They're writing a book on this subject, which has been available in some sort of form for quite some years now. I think the version I've got at home printed out is about 5 years old, and I keep wondering where and when it's going to appear. Okay, so that's, I think I had the honesty to admit that I'm more of a Levy man than a diffusion man, but never mind. One can work with diffusions. For example, Sorensen is one of the leading lights here. So if we work with diffusions, everything is lovely. I won't dwell here. Alex Mijatovic talked about diffusions just the other day. I'm going to be working with diffusions on the right half line, imposing the boundary condition that zero is a reflecting boundary. Think in terms of speed measure and scale function. Let's take the speed measure finite, so we can normalize it to be a probability measure on the half line. We're going to take this absolutely continuous with density little f. The diffusion is then ergodic and has a limit distribution as t goes to infinity, which is f, and the process is time reversible. We can pick up the density from the differential equation there. We're going to take the function sigma as known, because if we could observe the path exactly, we could find its quadratic variation and get sigma from that. And there's a whole slew of approximation results, which mean that one can approximate this in practice. The driving force behind all of this is Jean-Jacques Code, and it's lovely stuff. Okay, examples, the two that spring to mind are the gamma diffusion and the Cox-Ingersoll-Ross model. Apropos of gamma, just as the default picture for a diffusion on the line is Gaussian, the default picture for a diffusion, or for noise processes actually, on the half line is gamma. And I had an interesting conversation yesterday. We know that Gaussianity can be derived by maximum entropy arguments, and the same is true, I learned yesterday, about gamma on the right half line. So instead of it being simply my favorite example, it's actually justifiable by maximum entropy, which is very nice. And a few references for that at the bottom there. Okay, is time discrete or continuous? I love to ask classes this when I'm teaching stochastic processes. And I think the short answer is, well, the best answer to a question is a question. Are you wearing a digital watch, as I am, or does your watch have a sweep second hand, like that clock at the back there? Sweep second hands actually cheat, and you can see them jumping, but I'd like you to imagine an idealized sweep second hand, which performs simple harmonic motion. Is time discrete or continuous? Well, the answer, I think, is both. One can argue in favor of either. Data is discrete, and much, though by no means all, of econometrics works in discrete time, too. For current work in discrete time, I'm referring to the paper by Raphael Schmidt and Christian Schmieder. This has now been published, by the way. It came out in 2009 in the journal Insurance, Mathematics and Economics. In favor of continuous time, things work more smoothly in a continuum setting because we can do calculus in a continuum setting. And these days, students have never heard of the other kind of calculus. Of course, students know calculus. but there's another kind of calculus. Old-fashioned calculus books are called infinitesimal calculus. And when I was a lad, and I'm older than most people here, we were actually taught the calculus of finite differences as students. Students aren't. So calculus works more nicely in a continuous setting. And to sign off, a lot of current work is probing what happens if you take such methodology as Armour and Garch, which was developed in a discrete setting, and take it over to a continuous setting. And I've mentioned some names here, and I'll sign off by mentioning the work of the late Rex Bergström on econometric